Good afternoon, everyone. I'm opening a meeting of the House Energy and Environment Committee on Thursday, February 19th, 2015. Since we are still waiting for a few members, and I see Senator Roblin is visiting us, I'm going to go ahead and open a public hearing on House Bill 2632. Beth, would you give us a description of the bill again? Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2632 would direct the Oregon Department of Administrative Services to establish a program to incentivize the generation of electricity derived from solar energy. There is no revenue impact. There may be a fiscal impact. The statement hasn't been issued, and there is a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Excellent. Thank you. So we have Senator Roblin here, and Representative Benz, do you want to join him? Thank you. Welcome to the House
Thank
Energy and Environment Committee, Senator. In committee, as you remember, this is the one that we held over from last meeting.
Had a brief little testimony.
Madam Chair, I'm State Representative Cliff Benz, District 60, and I'm here today in support of House Bill 2632. And as you all know from my mentioning it previously, my district is very large, about 31% of Oregon, and large-scale solar makes a great deal of sense for that area. I think you're going to hear later that this particular project, if expanded to its full size, would cover about 4,000 acres, not all in one spot. My district is about 19 million acres, so 4,000 out of 19 million is a fairly modest area. And sometimes it's difficult to convey the size of the district, so I just refer to it as it's just slightly smaller than Texas. And in that fashion, get across to everyone the huge space that we have out there that we're not using. This particular concept of large-scale solar is actually playing out now in eastern Oregon. There are solar farms springing up. Idaho Power recently asked or let some contracts for solar farms in my district. It's quite interesting because in my law firm, we have folks come in then and ask us to craft contracts that between them and the power companies, Idaho Power in this case. It's interesting because landowners are very, very excited about this opportunity. And the reason, of course, has to do with the 20 or 40-year lease that allows them to generate a return on what otherwise is fairly marginal land. And the county also is generally very, very enthused about these large-scale solar operations because they are going to generate a property tax return on what otherwise is returning almost nothing to their county coffers. Many times people talk about distributed power, and it's a great idea to have different power generating sites in Oregon, particularly when a lot of our power now comes from perhaps Wyoming or further. So if there was disruption in that supply line, this power would be there. Now, we might have to figure out some way of accessing it, but at least we have the generating capacity local. The job creation, of course, for these operations is a lot initially and then not very much afterwards, but that's fine because the land is marginal use anyway, and there's not people working on it as we speak. So the property tax returns in the long run are excellent, as are the returns to the landowners. There's great reasons for this, and I know you've heard me talk before about I've always had mixed feelings about rooftop solar, and the reason has to do with whether or not we're truly advancing our interests when it comes to carbon and how much are we creating when those solar panels are built. There's articles that suggest if those panels are built in China, the carbon created in building the panels actually exceeds the savings of those panels over their life. Now, that's not true if they're built in Oregon, so we can avoid that difficulty. But the point is, in order to reach a point where this type of solar works using a broad scale approach, such as that which this bill would incent, works. And that's another really good reason to go big as opposed to, shall we say, rooftop. There's another reason for my supporting this bill, and it has to do with my concern that the techniques that we're using to address CO2 are modest, and in many cases perhaps look better than they actually work. This is different. This will generate power for a very long time with a very low CO2 impact. But more importantly, if we can begin to put together large projects, we can develop better ways of doing it. And I believe that the ultimate solution to the CO2 difficulties that our world faces is in research and development and doing clean things better. And this process actually moves us in that direction. And by that I mean it really will move us in that direction of doing things better. So for those reasons, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I support the bill and urge your support of it also.
And thank you, Chair Vega Peterson, rest of the committee. I'm Arne Roblin's House District 5, and you wonder why a person on the coast who has more clouds than they do over in Eastern Oregon would be here. A couple of reasons. One, it's always nice to explain to people that we get more sun than Eugene because they get fogged in, we don't, and other kinds of reasons. But the actual reason is that those of us in rural communities are looking for the way in which we can develop economic advantages for our areas that aren't necessarily available in urban and other places, and that jobs are important all across Oregon. Secondly, we have set goals for ourselves in this state to produce renewable energy. And I tend to agree. I think the rooftop solar can be something to look at individually for yourself. We've actually looked at it at our home recently. But if we're really going to get in the business of producing energy, we have to talk about large-scale issues. And we have done a good job with wind turbines in Eastern Oregon. This adds to that same portfolio by having large-scale solar. And the only way we actually get it to the prices that we need it is to start investing in it and making it happen. And you've got to have big-scale things to actually bring the cost down of production and other things over time. And so I look at this. It also, I had an opportunity this last summer to go to an institute, which Representative Reardon was at, and I think Representative Boone has already seen, and so has Representative Johnson, that PennWare puts on, the Lehigh Conference. And, you know, understanding better the need to have an energy system, when you start adding renewables in, it creates other kinds of problems for the base load for our systems. And we're fortunate because we have hydroelectric power and we've got some other things that are happening. But if you think about Eastern Oregon and a lot of our wind turbines, a lot of times when the wind slows down, it can be a very sunny day. And so for having alternative ways to get energy that is produced in generally from the sun so that they balance out over time makes it easier on the system to bring all that stuff in. And when you know the capacity of a unit as big as these large-scale ones, it's different from knowing how many houses have how many pieces of electricity, and all of a sudden it starts making the system that we have better and easier to balance. We also have a unique opportunity in this is to start thinking about how do we develop the battery systems that can collect this energy and put it back into the system when it's needed as opposed to and also help balance that capacity thing. We won't get there until we start making the investment in the beginning, and I think that's what we're here to talk about is how do we invest in a system and use the natural resources that we have in this state, and in this case, it's vast amounts of land and sun to help all Oregonians understand that we can make a difference with respect to all of this. So I appreciate the opportunity to come and speak to you and to be in support of one more way to force economic development in our rural areas, which has been sadly lacking over the last number of years. And it's great to be here with a friend who is at the end of a road that we keep trying to build from Coos Bay to Ontario.
Nice.
And Madam Chair, if I may add one more thing, I should have mentioned that the low profile of the solar arrays is much vastly superior to the much higher profile of wind. And so when it comes to placing these facilities out in my part of the world, we'd rather have those types of investments because they're not neighborhood affecting, shall we say. They blend in. And they're very quiet.
Just hear those electrons zipping through the line.
Thank you both so much. Are there any questions for Representative Rudin?
You both seem to indicated a kind of a tension between rooftop versus large scale. And I got part of the argument was the easier for the utilities to balance, larger arrays versus thousands of individual ones. Were there other reasons that you were thinking of?
And that's a big part. The other thing is that clouds make a difference with regard to this stuff, and a lot of our little arrays. When you're balancing power, the company has to keep sending power, and you have to be ready to accept it. The housetop ones are at an individual house level, and that I think that tends to put a little bit more pressure on the whole system to balance those, because you never know when that's going to happen. You can actually predict when that's going to happen in some of these other areas on a regular basis, because the weather is changing, and we've got better and better weather stuff, so you know when there's going to be those clouds and not. And I will tell you, on solar, it's like the wind. When a cloud goes over, you just watch the power production go down. When the wind slows down, you watch the power. And that's a big thing for Bonneville in our particular area, to balance those needs. They have a better chance of predicting what that's going to look like with these systems than they do with the housetop ones. Okay.
And if I may, Madam Chair, Representative Reardon, my focus has been on trying to get to the lowest cost replacement of energy that we can reach. And utility-sized solar gets you the lowest possible cost, as opposed to replicating 2 million rooftop systems, each roof being different, each system being different. And perhaps if we're getting better at it, but when you hear the subsequent testimony about how much sense this makes, when you can just put these things down by the thousands, it makes a lot of sense, because then we can run it into people's houses, mm-hmm. green power, at a much lower cost. And as coal goes offline or dams are taken out, such as may happen in the Klamath, that has to be replaced with green power, and we want the least expensive green we can get. So the hope is that this will advance that lower cost green power that's being mandated in so many situations. And I think we can get there faster with broad utility scale as opposed to rooftop.
And I also say that rooftop, when we were doing analysis for our house, whether it was cost effective one way or another, one of the issues was, do you own that tree? We said, why that tree? And he says, well, this is when we did all of our work, that's the way we're going to aim this solar panel to get the best use. So if you can take that tree out, or at least the top of it, you have a chance to be successful. If you don't have control of that tree, it's not going to be worth it to you. And that's what happens mm-hmm. with rooftop. You may not have any control over what the person plants next to you that could grow up into that sure. that dome. In places like this, where it's large scale, they're not concerned about those trees.
And he has no trees.
Yeah.
Representative Polley.
Thank you. I have spent a little bit of time looking at this and talking to Mr. Brown. Fully support the concept and the policy behind this. It all makes sense. I just am still a little bit troubled by how this gets funded. This is funded from the general fund, which means we'll be taking money from education and potentially other places to get this going. It makes sense to get this sort of established for, I recognize there's other funds that may go into this at some point, potentially, but I was just looking for maybe a more viable way to fund this. I think it's going to be challenged for us in this session to really get this off the ground. And so I'm kind of curious why the consideration for having a base of ratepayers in the particular region or the utility district that this is coming from to help subsidize this instead of the state general fund. I mean, I'd like to see this take off, and I think it's just really challenged to fund it through the general fund.
The only thing I would say with respect to ratepayers in the local area, there are very few ratepayers in this local area. I mean, if you look at the vast areas and the number of people that are there, that makes it very difficult. And the actual beneficiaries are all of the people in Oregon. And so it's that conversation that we have. We've made some public policy decisions, which we believe are in the best interest of the public in Oregon. One of them has to do with green power. And if that's the case, then I think there is a public input into that. General fund is part of that. If we can find some others, I'd love to find opportunities to do the same kind of thing in other ways. We have made some, in this session in particular, made some real decisions about how much we're going to put into any tax breaks one way or the other, and it's going to have to fight through that. All of these are going to have to fight through that process, and that happened in 2011 the first time, and I think it's a good process because we start making some of those kinds of decisions. But as a state, I think every time we start making public policy decisions on things, we have to recognize that where is that going to come from? And it's one of those things that I think we have to have a conversation. And it's going to be difficult to have one small section of place, which has a lot of area but not very many people, bear the cost of producing this kind of power for a lot of other people. That would be my opinion.
And Madam Chair, if I may, the members of the committee, Representative Holy, the federal tax credit expires in 2016, 30%. And the federal government, in many of its mandates, I'll use that word, is suggesting that we need to go green. And if that's the case, then indeed the federal government should pick up part of this cost. I'm very happy that the folks behind this bill are asking that it go through Ways and Means. I think this choice is best placed squarely before Ways and Means to be measured against all the other needs you mentioned. And we should ask ourselves, where does this fit in that list of priorities? How important is it truly to have green power? Is it more important than the other choices they're going to be making? I'm very happy that we're going to have that opportunity to think about those choices.
Yeah, I thank you, Madam Chair. I'm, you know, clearly agree. I think it's good to get the policy established. I just worry about its future, and was hoping that there may be some other mechanisms we could put in place to really get it started and have a little more certainty that of its immediate success.
How big of we're all trying to reduce carbon here these days, and so how big of a chunk or how big of a bite is this taking out of our carbon footprint as a state, or how much of the power will be replaced? Any idea?
I'm sure. I think that's the question best left for
the experts.
We've got some other folks coming up.
I think they have
that's
the answer.
Question. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering how significant it is.
Hold on to that, okay. And we'll probably have some folks up there. Thank you both so much for your testimony today. All right, so next I'm going to call up David Brown and Hillary Barber. And is Mark Penn? I think he was here yesterday, but I don't see him here. So why don't we have David and Hillary come up? Thank you both. And when you're ready, go ahead and introduce yourself for the record.
For the record, my name is David Brown, and my company is Obsidian Renewables. If anybody's watching over the web, I have two pieces of testimony that the committee administrator has posted on the committee's website. Thank you very much, Chair Vega Peterson, for having this hearing today. I'm really very excited to be here to talk about House Bill 2632. I worked with a very great number of people and with elected representatives for about a year and a half fashioning this bill, trying to understand where the issues are and how we could put together a bill that didn't just work in PG and Pacific Service Territory, but across the whole state, that wasn't a mandate, that didn't make people do things, but that allowed them to choose to do things that were becoming more and more attractive to them anyway. I listened to the consumer-owned utility or customer-owned utilities about what they were looking for and the special needs they have because of Bonneville and because of their buying through PNGC, another cooperative that they use to acquire power. And so we came up with a bill that is before you here today, and I'd be very happy to describe it. Green power projects produce a renewable energy credit or a green tag. And they're called RECs, R-E-C, REC, not the kind that happens on the freeway. But so those renewable energy credits represent the bragging rights, if you will, the greenness of the power. Sometimes the RECs are bundled with the power or stapled. That makes the power continue to be attractive. Sometimes the RECs are traded separately, and those are unbundled RECs or separately traded RECs. They're considered a little bit less attractive in the marketplace. So the utilities, I think at the direction of the Public Utility Commission, who I think had been given guidance on this exact point by the legislature, presented a renewable energy avoided cost. What is the lowest cost renewable energy resource available to us, and what would be a fair price to pay for that power? And candidly, we can build solar today for those renewable energy avoided costs. They were adopted for the first time earlier or late last year. But when they were adopted, they were also suspended at the same time for 7 years because the utilities explained to the PUC that they had a sufficient amount of renewable energy at this time, so they didn't need to buy more renewable energy, so we should wait for those costs to take effect. You can imagine I was disappointed. But so what this bill does is it kind of fills that trough. So if I build a renewable energy project, I get brown power prices for 7 years, and then I get green power prices, and the green power prices are great. So I need some help during those brown power years, and that's what this bill does. And in exchange for that, I'm transferring the new renewable energy credit to the state. And I'm not telling the state what to do with it. They can retire it. Frankly, my own personal view would be the state should use it to reduce its own coal by wire profile. They could make them available to help companies satisfy carbon tax requirements or other requirements that are being developed. They could use them, they could resell them if they wanted to. So all those are available. The utilities might want to buy them. There's lots of possibilities. I leave that to the state to judge what's best. I'm also very hopeful that, see, by doing this, the state gives me something that I can take to a bank. My promise to go do my best to sell these renewable energy credits is not bankable, as they say, because there's no market. There's no proven market. But if the state, through this bill, establishes a proven market, then I will be doing my best to, instead of selling them to the state, to sell them to Nike, to sell them to Starbucks, sell them to Columbia Sportswear. I think there are customers who are looking to acquire interests in large solar, but it's kind of a what comes first, the cart or the horse. There are no projects to provide them those renewable energy credits, and those projects can't be built without a market for the renewable energy credits. So I really think that there's a good chance that the state establishing this marketplace will see a genuine marketplace develop. It has for wind renewable energy credits, just hasn't yet for solar. So I've given some detailed questions and answers. I don't like to read testimony because I know that you all look at it quite a bit. I also have prepared a two-page summary of facts. And so on the question, how much coal are we talking about? So one of the things I had to do to be able to come up with facts is I had to estimate, gee, how much do I think will be built? One of the lessons that we learned lots and lots of lessons from she who cannot be named. But one of the lessons we learned is don't underestimate the impact of a program. So I'm telling you, I wrote these numbers at 500 megawatts. We have 85 megawatts in the state today. 500 is a really big number. I think we can do it. I don't know, but I'm not underestimating. So at 500 megawatts over the 30-year life of these projects, that's 8.25 million tons of coal. That's 275,000 tons of coal a year. That's about 8,200 coal cars a year. It's 22 million avoided tons of carbon dioxide. So this is a kind of a big number. Also, I'm extremely proud of how much the cost of solar has come down and how a program like this can help drive down the cost of solar further. And so confident am I that the bill itself drops the cost level of the renewable energy credits 10% a year over the life of the bill, kind of forcing us to do it cheaper, do it better. And we can do that. The biggest problem I have as a developer of larger scale projects is I haven't developed one in 2 years. I mean, nobody has. Oregon hasn't had a larger scale project built in the last 2 years. And so I don't have a bank that's lined up. I don't have contractors who I just finished a project with. It. Every time I do a project, you kind of start over, and you can save a lot of money if you have a pipeline. So this would help us. It's not just me. There's lots of developers who would come and do this, but we'll have a pipeline, and that will help drive down costs also. Experience drives down costs. I'm proud to have all of my projects done by qualified, highly qualified members of the IBEW, and experience really helps. So that's another way we're driving down costs. Anyway, I can answer questions and go into any level of detail. I'm so excited about this idea. Thank you very much.
Go ahead, and Hillary, why don't you go ahead, and then we'll do our questions for the whole panel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Hillary Barber. I'm the policy director with Renewable Northwest, and we're a member organization. We support the responsible development of renewable resources in Oregon and throughout the Pacific Northwest. And we are very proud to support HB 2632, a bill that provides rational, common sense incentives for utility scale solar in Oregon. Solar's well-documented declining costs make it an increasingly attractive and cost-effective investment for utilities that are seeking to fill customer demands for renewable energy. In addition, utility-scale solar projects help Oregon's investor-owned utilities comply with Oregon's renewable portfolio standard. These projects also bring, as we've heard earlier, economic development and jobs to rural parts of our state. We think HB 2632 provides appropriately scaled incentives, which do decline over time, that will spur project development and leverage investment to promote the solar industry's growth in Oregon, and we would be pleased to answer any questions, but strongly support the bill. Thank you.
Questions from the panel? Representative Colby.
Just one, I was just kind of curious, you know, I know that there's a piece of consultation in here with the Department of Energy, but why DAS instead of just Department of Energy? Because you're asking DAS to do a lot of things that seems like it's out of their kind of purview of expertise.
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Holvey, thank you for the question. I don't know that I quite got that right, because it was just me sort of thinking about it as opposed to really having a lot of advice on the point. But my idea was that this was sort of like the state subscribing for a green tariff. And DAS is the company that pays the utility bills. And so I just saw it as a supplement to the utility bill. And there really isn't any policy. It's just administrative. So I thought that DAS would be the best one. Now, if the state wanted to look at selling the RECs or something like that, then I think you'd probably want to give that responsibility to the Department of Energy. I don't think that fits in DAS's purview. But I just saw this as purely kind of bookkeeping and administrative. At least that was my thinking, sir.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in the handout, there's a estimate of how much property tax would be paid by the total build-out of 500 megawatts. But if we drop that down to 100 megawatts for one project, the number is still around $24,000 a year over the 30 years for property taxes. Do I have that right?
So my property tax estimate, first, it's kind of hard to do because, unfortunately, but anyway, these projects currently are subject to central assessment, and I know that you've heard recently that it's difficult to know exactly where you come out on central assessment. But so I've done my best to figure this out. The math is really this simple, Representative Benz. It's $7,000 of tax per year per megawatt for 30 years. So I took the life cycle of the project. I took the initial construction cost. I built that down to zero. I took off the federal tax credits. And then I kind of amortized it down and averaged it. Later we will, I hope you have me back to talk about an idea I have to actually pay property taxes on a levelized basis over the whole life of the project, because that helps my financing so much. But that was my idea. I think this tax number that I've given you is really quite conservative. There's no inflation built into it or anything like that. It's just all constant dollars.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Vice Chair Johnson.
Mr. Brown, where do you anticipate building these or this system? What sort of land use obstacles might you encounter? Have you already got that figured out as well?
Representative Vega Peterson, Representative Johnson, three times I've told Representative Benz I'm not building them all in his district.
He's off.
So, in terms of number of projects, I've built more in Klamath Falls than anywhere else. I do like, I just adore Lake County, and I've built a number of projects there. The sunniest part of the state is the area south of Bend and from Klamath all the way to the Idaho border. As you get into Malheur County, there just aren't very many power lines, and so you're not going to be able to build very much out there. These projects will be built. They'll be built outside of Hermiston. They'll be built outside of the Dalles. They'll be built in Boardman. They'll be built in Madras, Prineville. They have to be built on grazing land for two reasons. One, can't afford to build it on irrigated farmland. And number two, Oregon, you may have heard this, but they have really strict land use rules. And we're just not allowed to build these on irrigated farmland. When we come to the Willamette Valley, there's going to be a challenge on finding appropriate sites. And there'll be landfills, there'll be former industrial sites, brownfields, there'll be probably smaller projects because of land use concerns. But it's going to be more difficult, and I've been asked a couple of times if it's time to sort of reopen the land use discussion on how to balance it. My own view was it's important to get some of these built so people can go look at them and understand them, and then it'll be a little easier to continue that land use discussion. Thank you.
Follow up. Just to confirm then, we were talking private land for this.
Yes.
And
yes.
Is there a minimum critical mass to make one feasible? Obviously, you can scale up to any size, I'm sure, but what would be the minimum size that would meet the criteria for making it feasible? And I don't know how you quantify acres or panels or square feet or whatever calculation you have.
So one of my colleagues spoke on Tuesday at the kind of potpourri hearing about solar, and he said that he thought you started to get to meaningful economies of scale at 2 megawatts. I agree with that. We're interested in 2 megawatts in this bill. That's the floor in the bill is 2 megawatts. That would be 12 acres. Okay. 5 megawatts, I view as kind of a desirable minimum. That would be 40 acres.
Okay. And I had a question for you in terms of you'd mentioned, the area where these potential or the types of ways that these RECs could be used. I know that there's interest in different technology companies who are having data centers out in central and eastern Oregon to have. They want to have the clean energy to help power those. Have you had any discussions with those folks, or is that something that you see as a possible for the future coming out of this?
Yes. Chair Vega Peterson, thank you very much for this question. This is, I'm going to take it as an interesting policy question, a little bit apart from the bill, but still, thank you. We now have had confirmed by many data centers that they're dead serious about green energy. And I think this bill will let us start the conversation about green energy right off the bat when they're talking about coming here. And I think we'll be able to put together attractive, cost-effective green energy solutions. And Dave Markham from Central Electric Co-op was here Tuesday, and he gave his testimony then because he couldn't come back today. But he has talked to data centers, and they've asked him, what can you do in renewable energy? And they've never done anything before. They've always just been a complete BPA customer. And so Dave's a creative, energetic man, and he's trying to think, okay, if what can we do for our customers? And I know that PGE and Pacific Power are also very much having those conversations internally. It represents a change in thinking about the utility model, and those kinds of changes aren't easy. The PUC has opened a docket called UM 1690, which is on the green tariff. I think this legislature directed them to do that, and as part of that bill last year, the Umatilla Electric compromise bill, and in my view, that has kind of bogged down a little bit. But some very interesting things I think are gonna come out of that investigation by the PUC.
Thank you both very much. Representative Benson.
Thank you. I just want to mention, the witness mentioned the land being grazing land. And just the day before I got in my car and drove down here 3 weeks ago, I was doing a ranch deal, a very large one, 40, 50,000 deeded acres, and we had it appraised. And the sagebrush land appraised for between $250 and $350 an acre. So that's what it sells for. So when we talk about 1,000 acres or 40 acres at $250 to $300, that's why we call it marginal land. And so this is the type of area that he would be looking at in my district. And again, we have 6 million acres of that marginal land in just one of the five counties I represent. So it's extremely important that we get across to everyone that space in my part of the world is, there's a lot of it, and it's not very expensive. So I again think we need to be thinking on these. When we start speaking large scale, it works over in my part of the world because of the very low price of land.
Thank you. All right. Representative Biden?
Just for the record, I would like to let Representative Bentz know that that could invade on some of my sage rat hunting that goes on out in his district, and the solar panels could get in the way.
Thank you, Representative Weiner. Thank you both so much.
One more question?
Oh, we're just going. Go ahead.
Just one more, you know, for fear of or putting myself in danger of having all the utilities stand up and start throwing things at me. But I do want to ask this question about, you know, the funding mechanism on this. You must have sort of penciled out how much money this needs from the general fund. And I'm just wondering if you've sort of tried to pencil out, you know, what a surcharge on ratepayers or statewide would be to get to this funding level, as opposed to asking the general fund to pay for it. What kind of rate increase would we need to do statewide to make this happen?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Holvey, again, thank you for the question.
Do you mean that?
No. I'm going to answer it. I'm happy to answer it. But first, let me say that the benefits, in my view, are statewide. The benefits of bringing down the cost of solar, putting ourselves in a position to really be a significant solar state, it will be beneficial to everyone. Secondly, one of the things that I learned, and the Umatilla bill last year was part of my guidance, is that the customer-owned utilities don't want a mandate. They don't want to be told what to do. And I came up with an idea that I think the utilities will either support or be neutral on, and together with support from the other advocates, I think that's a pretty darn good balance. The answer to your question, what's the cost? Over the course of 11 years, which is the length of the program, each project is subsidized or sells RECs for 7 years, but then you can come into the program. So the total program is 11 years. The cost at 500 megawatts is, by my calculations, about $83 million. So that's about $7.5 million a year. It ramps up. These projects take at least a year to get built, so there's not much of an effect in the first biennium, but then it ramps up after that. $7.5 million as a percentage of the statewide utility bills would be a very small number. You'd be in the less than 0.1%. It's not a very big number, but it would have to be a mandate, and I deliberately stayed away from that.
Thanks. That's good to know that you thought about it.
Yes.
Representative Hurd.
Just a quick question. How many average homes will 1 megawatt, or as you say, a 2 megawatt minimum project power?
Chair Vega-Peterson, Representative Hurd, you're asking me to do math right here on the floor. It's 66,000 homes for 500 megawatts. So 2 megawatts would be 1/250th of that.
So 66,000 homes for the 500 megawatts?
Yeah.
Sorry, we had to make you do math. But.
When I was younger, I could have done that right now.
Okay, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Next, I'm going to call up Varner Seaman, Joe Esmond, and Nancy Metella. Good afternoon, everybody. Go ahead and I don't really care who starts. Joe, do you want to go first?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Vega Peterson, and committee members. I'm Nancy Metella. I'm a volunteer with Tax Fairness Oregon, and we definitely like this bill. We do have some concern, though, that it could be a Betsy 2. And we did submit the testimony this morning. I don't know if it was received electronically, but I would like to tell you our concern and a proposed amendment that would help us to support it totally. This bill is a sensible idea that will help Oregon address climate change issues and encourage increased growth of the solar industry. The concept is far more reason than the Betsy program, both in its subsidy, design, and its push of commercial scale rather than residential scale solar facilities. However, a second part of the bill should prohibit data centers from using this program. Seems like data centers are being picked on these last couple of weeks, but so be it. Let's not turn this positive program into Betsy 2, where only a few large corporations unrealistically prosper from multiple well-intentioned state programs on the backs of all Oregonians. As you probably read in Monday's front page article on data centers' benefits from enterprise zone breaks, tax breaks in Hillsboro, this industry is already benefiting handsomely from our property tax structure and absence of sales tax. And of course, none of us knows what income taxes the businesses pay Oregon. But we do know they devour energy. In recent years, and at heavy expense to the state, we've increased the renewable energy production in Oregon. New renewables are now 6% or more of our energy supply. But data centers are such hungry energy users that they are now gobbling up roughly half of that new energy. Meanwhile, researchers with our group have found that only 36% are built to ENERGY STAR efficiency standards. Shouldn't we require that in Oregon? Thus, our concern would be addressed if we proposed an additional amendment that requires that new data center facilities in rural areas build their own facilities to provide 60% of their own energy through their own sourced renewable energy production, and that urban facilities pay the upcharge for renewable energy available through our electricity suppliers. Building their own power production facilities is a growing model for the industry. You may have read recently about Apple in California. They're putting in a huge, vast array of solar panels. The requirement would not be onerous. We asked two experts the following question. Given an industrial-sized solar farm in Oregon along the Columbia River or in Prineville serving a data center, roughly how long might it take for the cost to be returned by the savings? Their responses were, and I know that's misspelled, the first guy said he would need more information on size, but likely 10 years with a federal ITC. The second person said, this is really rough, but without the federal ITC, it would be about 14 years. With the ITC, I get 9 years. Through an accelerated depreciation and payback, would drop. Data centers should be commended for greening up with ever more efficient, energy-efficient facilities and installed solar, wind, and new hydro here in Oregon, across the U.S., and around the world. But we shouldn't ask the state's budget to help these businesses pay for their good business practices. Instead of using this program to subsidize their commitment, we could require them to be at least Energy Star efficient and to create their own solar energy or other renewable energy where there is ample land, or to buy green energy where not. That way, these high energy using but low job producing businesses will be contributing more to Oregon by enhancing our renewable energy mix. We don't want this bill to turn into a Betsy 2. And to address Representative Holvey's concern and everyone's concern about cost, we're toying with the idea of combining this effort with the Energy Trust. They're already an administrative arm of the utilities' contributions towards alternative energy. And rather than having a whole new system here with the state, that perhaps Energy Trust could be a source and reduce the cost of this program. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Varner Seaman, representing Portland General Electric. In looking at this bill, there's a lot here that I think is pretty intriguing to us, and that, especially from the cost standpoint, is very appealing for utilities that are looking at buying large amounts of power and wanting to keep the rates in check. One of the things that Representative Benz talked about was the sort of the increased affordability of larger scale projects versus some of the smaller scale projects. And I want to talk a little bit about how we see some of the specific numbers in that comparison. As we look at this proposal in HB 2632, where essentially a utility would be buying the underlying power or the brown power at what would be an avoided cost rate, and then the state would be buying the renewable energy credit, which would effectively be the above market cost of the purchase of that power, we would look at the price of these projects coming in to Oregonians, exclusive of the federal tax federal investment tax credit, so just the part that ratepayers in the state would be paying, coming in roughly $80 to $85 to $90, about in that range per megawatt hour. By contrast, when we look at two programs that are designed to incentivize small-scale distributed generation, or oftentimes what we call rooftop solar, the first thing I want to talk about is a recent report that came out of the PUC, dated January 1. It's on the front page of the PUC's homepage. I think it's, for folks on this committee, I think it's pretty, should be recommended reading. Looking at small-scale projects that came in under the feed-in tariff or the volumetric incentive rate, those projects started off in July of 2010 in PGE service territory being compensated at a rate of $650 per megawatt hour. And that ratcheted down to, at the end of the program in April of 2004, $390 per megawatt hour, or about 39 cents per kilowatt hour. So by comparison, as we're looking at this, again, we would see projects that we would be buying at avoided cost, which is effectively what we would pay for a natural gas, which is the lowest other conventional generation in the status quo, plus this cost of the state, cost to Oregonians, total under HB 2632 being around about $85 an hour, ballpark. When we look at net metered projects, and we had one of our analysts do a comparison to look at the value of the residential energy tax credit, the energy trust funds that come from ratepayers that are then it's collected through the public purpose charge, rebated to the energy trust, and then some of that money going out towards renewable energy projects, and then paying for net metering at the retail rate. We come up with a total cost for net metered projects on a per megawatt hour basis of about $240 per megawatt hour. For net metered projects. So when we compare this and the large scale projects versus some of the distributed projects, what we see is that we're seeing the potential just on an energy basis in terms of what we're paying for the energy. And again, this is all setting aside any property tax treatment that could vary by projects or the federal tax treatment through the investment tax credit or accelerated depreciation. So just those things coming from ratepayers and taxpayers in the state of Oregon. We anticipate under this program that the cost would be maybe a fourth or a fifth of what some of the smaller scale projects would be. So just wanted to put a little bit of a fine point in terms of how much more cost effective this program could be versus some of the other things we're doing in terms of scaling up on renewable energy. There are a couple things that I just wanted to clarify a little bit on this program and slightly different from what folks were saying in the other testimony. The first is, if the state is buying the renewable energy credit or the REC, the energy from these projects would not be eligible for utilities to meet the state renewable portfolio standard. RECs are often referred to as the currency of compliance. The way that we meet the renewable portfolio standard is by purchasing renewable energy credits and retiring those renewable energy credits. If the state were to purchase those renewable energy credits, we wouldn't be able to use those for our own compliance purposes. There is a challenge with that, which creates what we call null power. So for a utility that is buying renewable energy, energy produced from a renewable project, but we're not also purchasing the renewable energy credit for it, we don't get to, in essence, count the greenness of those projects. And in some scenarios, in some compliance scenarios, we're actually given an imputed carbon value. So you can have an underlying renewable energy source, but the energy is considered brown power. It's something that, especially as we look at the declining cost of utility scale solar, it's becoming a little bit of an issue for utilities that do have renewables and other programs or other obligations that can be a challenge for us. With that said, one of the other things folks were talking about was Department of Administrative Services as the entity administering this program. I think that that makes some sense to us as a place as opposed to the Department of Energy, and we think that's an appropriate place for it. We also like that this is not a mandate and that it's available to all utilities statewide as opposed to just for the investor-owned utilities. So generally speaking, there's a lot to like about this plan for us as a utility. We'd essentially be buying the solar power under this program at an avoided cost rate, and that would be essentially the same for us as buying natural gas or another type of fossil generation on a cost basis. That's pretty attractive to us in terms of both incentivizing solar energy while also keeping the rates fairly modest, or hopefully ratepayers think those are modest rates. With that said, as we look at solar policy as a sort of as a totality of the different bills that we're looking at for solar yet this session, We have some concern that we don't necessarily want to have a series of kind of one-off bills on solar, that we would like for this committee and for the legislature to deal with solar as a package or sort of as one area of policy. And so our preference would be that the committee not, if you're intending to look at other areas of solar policy, that you not pass this bill out before we have a chance to look at what the other solar programs are that you're considering, and that we look at this as a package. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Oh, Joe, one more. You were so polite. Go ahead.
Clean up.
Yeah.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Joe Esmond. I represent the IBEW Local 48 in Portland, Oregon, and I probably one of the only people in this room who actually is an electrician. So I know thereof when I talk. First of all, I want to start to say I'm very excited about this. Some of us, one of this, Representative Huffman and I, started many years ago, it seems like, to try to incentivize solar on the other side of the mountains, on rangeland, and we called it Solar Rocks. It was that arid. Well, it didn't go anywhere. Very frustrating. And I think some of you are aware of conversations, or at least I've been in rooms where people say, we don't want fossil fuels, we want renewables. Okay, wind, solar, okay. This to me, and I don't use this term hardly at all, is be a win-win for everyone. Our union, we've trained over 3,000 members in solar installation, and quite frankly, it's something that we do along with this kind of stuff, windmills, et cetera. I could probably have in a week a contractor and manpower on the ground ready to go to start this project. Give me a month. Our people travel to the middle of nowhere as part of the job, set this stuff up. If we had the installation up in 20 years, the technology changes, most of the infrastructure will already be in the ground. The pipe work, the ditch, the pipe work, the wiring, and the power, and the transmission line. We worked with Mr. Brown's company very well. He was very happy, as he mentioned, with what he got. So I don't see any bad to this at all, especially the cheap power. And again, what somebody mentioned about the green tariff, many companies want to have that on their logo as part of the selling things. So I think it's a very good thing. And let's go do it. I'll take any questions or brickbats or anything.
Thank you. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Joe, are you saying this would be a win-win without wind?
Oh. Keep your day job, Representative. Yeah.
That's the problem.
Representative Boone.
Thank you.
But I will add that the wind part, too, would be we have a major solar manufacturer in the state, and we have a major solar inverter manufacturer in the state, and that would be great to put those, get some more work for them. American made. Truth be told, the IBEW weighed in on the tariff cases back in D.C. We don't want stuff here from China. We have people here in America who can make those damn things. So.
Mm-hmm. Representative Boone.
Thank you. And thank you, Joe. You kind of took some of the words out of my mouth. I was going to talk about that, too. But I'd like to thank Mr. Brown and his company. Worked with him for some years and on the task force, too. And I happen to be a believer in the Betsy. I think it's a good program. It was a good program. And people who take the risk and put a lot of money into projects deserve to have a little help to, defray some of that. And they're fine with a limiting on it. So I don't think it's a bad thing. And I think that for someone like Mr. Brown and others who do these projects around our state, kudos to them for helping us get to where we really want to be, and Joe's people for hooking it up. So thanks, Joe.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Varner, just some clarification regarding data centers and their
loads, as we heard some concern about, in exchange for the green or the renewable power that they are interested in purchasing, they're buying that at quite a bit of a premium price, are they not? It's a little different than your typical industrial or manufacturing power retail rates, correct?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Johnson, it depends on how they do that. Essentially, and Mr. Brown earlier was talking about the bundled transactions versus unbundled transactions. And so, you know, as we mm-hmm. look at renewable energy, essentially every time the meter produces a megawatt hour, you produce one renewable energy credit or one REC. If you're buying in one transaction both the renewable energy credit and the underlying what we refer to as brown power, or you know, without the renewable energy credit, it's considered, you know, not renewable. All the attributes under Oregon law of public benefit or public health improvement or environmental attributes are all contained under Oregon statute. They're defined as being contained within the value of that renewable energy credit. Renewable energy credits for wind in the Pacific Northwest are currently pretty cheap, relatively speaking. You can buy those in an unbundled transaction, meaning you're not necessarily buying the power, you're just buying system power and you're putting renewable energy credits on top of that, and you're using that for compliance mm-hmm. and you're having that certified. You could do it with wind today for a pretty low price, you know, $1.60. Under this program, we're talking about starting at $30 a megawatt hour, $30 a rack, and then a declining price over time, as Mr. Brown discussed, a ratcheting down. So folks can do that, and I think one of the questions is, as we go forward, is people are wanting to switch, or the companies that are doing some of these purchases are wanting to switch from unbundled or REC-only transactions to bundled or transactions. So you're buying both the output and actually having the physical delivery from the energy facility with that renewable energy credit. In that case, you'd actually be having to pay market rate for having that project built. So that could be anywhere from, you know, 85 to, you know, low $100 range, depending on what the resource was that you were purchasing from.
Okay, thanks.
Representative Holvey.
Thank you. I apologize for obsessing on how to fund this thing. And it's just that I'd like to see it happen. So, Ms. Brown, you mentioned using funds from the Energy Trust to help offset the cost of implementing this. I'm just curious whether energy trust funds could be used outside of the IOU territories to invest in this type of project.
Representative Holvey, this was only a brainstormed idea this morning. We haven't checked with the party that we're talking about, so I can't tell you, but we can get back to you about that.
Thanks. Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Holvey, and for the record, I haven't thrown anything at you, and I don't intend to. that would be untoward. The Energy Trust is funded through rates collected from PGE and PacifiCorp customers, and the intent is that those dollars would be spent in the service territories of PGE and PacifiCorp. And we would object pretty strongly to spending Energy Trust dollars outside of our service territories. The public power entities in the state, through Bonneville, do quite a bit of work funding energy efficiency and weatherization programs, other things similar to the Energy Trust. If I go back and I don't mention that, Ted Case is going to throw something at me. but so with that said, I think generally folks want to have the benefits that ratepayers are paying from their service territory accruing back to their own service territory.
Thanks.
Vice Chair Rudin.
Warner, always enjoy hearing your presentations. They're very informative, but you threw out about a large variety of different numbers today and how that could affect the pricing. Do you have like a cheat sheet on that by any chance that talks about different prices? I didn't see anything in your testimony. Is there something you could provide later that's not?
Chair Vic Peterson, Representative Rudin, I'd be happy to sit down with you and walk through some of the numbers. The basic, just the report that I was referring to holding up here is from it's on the PUC's webpage. It's the, again, it's January 1 report talking about solar photovoltaic easy to say, a volumetric incentive program or the feed-in tariff program. And that goes through and talks a lot about solar pricing, and it breaks out.
From the work group last year?
So we had a pilot project that has sunset on it. It was extended during the 13 session on the feed-in tariff. This basically goes through and does some comparison of the pricing between net metering and what. So I'm really just reading from a PUC report.
I'll go back and look at it because that's the group that I chaired. So.
Yes.
Any comment?
Oh, yeah.
So this comment's for Joe. There are two electricians in a room. I was a Marine electrician in 1974. So.
That's the start of a joke. A representative of Reardon, that's the start of a joke. How many electricians does it take? if I may just add another thing to your chair. We have less solar developed than New Jersey, which isn't. Probably put 5 New Jerseys, maybe 10 in your district, Representative Benz?
At least.
At least. So
20.
And we beat our chest about being a green state. We beat our chest about no coal, though I've survived living in West Virginia for 5 years somehow. This, to me, we could really make a huge leap in this to get off of the coal and do the solar. And the state, I know, lots of goals, lots of aspirational goals from states and counties and cities and energy efficiency. This could kind of leapfrog over there for the same amount, for less money per megawatt saved or developed. So thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Is the sunshine in
New Jersey? Representative
Benz. Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just checking. Indeed, New Jersey is smaller than Malheur County, which is just about half the size of Malheur. Anyway, the
Garden
question,
State?
The question is really to build, it was for Varner, but it was building on what Joe just said. And it's the question is, with a 500 megawatt build out, is that a game changing effort? In other words, part of my hope has been that this process would, and this investment would result in a driving down of these costs, an improvement that we could share with other folks on a scale that lends itself to saying, yes, we did this, and now we can do it better, and we can do it cheaper. Is this of a size that lends itself, in your opinion, and all your opinions, to that type of an outcome?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Benz. It's a good question, and there are two ways to get at it. I mean, the one of the things that we've seen, I think there was some pretty good presentation on Tuesday in front of this committee about the declining price of solar in the discussions that in some of the testimony that took place. When we look at solar and the declining cost of solar capacity, or the per panel price essentially, or what's the per watt price, at this point, solar is a global commodity. And when we look at the technological innovations that are taking place, you know, some of that is from Chinese production, and some of it may be from dumping from China. I think there have been those concerns raised in trade cases. We've got manufacturers globally, and we've got markets for solar that are developing globally. I'm not sure, in all candor, that 500 megawatts developed in Oregon over the next 10 years necessarily would be a game changer in terms of changing the technology for what is essentially now a global commodity. When we look at reports from the solar industry, I think one of the things that is important for this committee to know is that the solar industry nationally and globally is extremely healthy and extremely strong. When we look in the last few years, solar installations in terms of a per megawatt capacity installation rate is second only to natural gas. It's surpassed wind in a lot of different places as the prices have declined. So given the tremendous volume of solar being installed globally and nationally, I don't know that it would necessarily drive a market change with an additional 500 megawatts in Oregon, in all candor. We're a relatively small state, although an important one. What I do think it would potentially, and I think what Mr. Brown is talking about, where I think it would start to eke out some savings, is having some consistency in terms of uptake or of procurement of these projects. And I think that would, beyond the panel price, it would have, the more we're working on these projects, installing them, I think it would drive down some of those costs and help scale up that way.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on this bill? Okay, thank you all so much. With that, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2632, and I'm going to open an informational meeting on the Bottle Drop Oregon Redemption Centers. Yes, so please, I'd like to call up John Anderson and Joe Gilliam. Don't take it personally.
It's over, it's over 11 years. Yeah, I have to. This is the best way.
Welcome so much, gentlemen. Thank you for being here today. Go ahead and you can start and introduce yourself for the record.
Okay. Well, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Anderson. I'm president of Oregon Beverage Recycling Co-op, and
I'm Joe Gilliam, president of Northwest Grocery Association, representing retail stores around the state.
So I've got a presentation that I'll go through here, and Joe, you just kick me under the table when I get it wrong.
Okay.
I have a few websites down here that you can refer to for most of this information if you don't have a hard copy of it. There's a lot of history of the bottle bill here, so I'll go quickly. It was passed in 1971. You guys probably know that. Didn't have any real significant changes until 2007 with the passage of Senate Bill 707. And Senate Bill 707 added water and flavored water. Prior to that, it was carbonated and malt-based beverages. Additionally, it required universal brand acceptance at large retailers, which basically meant Fred Meyer had to take Safeway's products back, and Safeway had to take Fred Meyer's and Walmart, and everybody had to take everybody. So a major change in how the bottle bill operated in the prior 40 or 30-some years. The next change really came into effect when the Senate Bill 707 came into effect in 2009, and that resulted in the formation of Oregon Beverage Recycling Co-op, which is a co-op that formed out of a company called Container Recovery, which was a regional co-op in the greater Portland-Salem metro area. OBRC, which is the company that I represent, picks up at 3,000 locations. We deliver the product that we pick up, 3,000 grocery locations. We deliver the product we picked up, or we pick up to five plants around the state. We employ about 250 people, and we have a $25 million budget to do that. We also provide funding and management for ORPET, which is a company out in St. Helens, Oregon, that processes all of Oregon's bottle bill plastic bottles. So those get returned to grocery stores. We pick them up, and we bail them up, and we take them out to ORPET, and ORPET washes and flakes them and sells them to other recyclers to be put back into bottles or other recycled products. Then in 2011, House Bill 3145 passed. It provided for a deposit increase in 2017 to 10 cents if the redemption rate doesn't reach 80%. And then it also added a new class of covered beverage products in 2018, in January 1 of 2018, which would include juices, teas, sports drinks, and various other combinations that have come onto the market. So those currently aren't included. And then in 2013, Senate Bill 117 passed, and that authorized an expanded redemption center program with some statutory parameters, primarily related to convenient zones, which are 2 miles and 3.5 miles. And then it also required non-participating retailers to meet specific convenience criteria. In other words, if a redemption center opened and a retailer chose not to participate, but they were within one of the convenience zones, that retailer had to make sure they provided convenient enough services that the customers wouldn't choose a redemption center and essentially allow the retailer to sell the products but not be responsible for taking them back. So what's next? Well, really, right now it's 2017. Is the deposit increase, which I say is likely. We're in the second of the two measurement years that the bill spelled out. The first year, we were around 70%, and I don't expect that we will be any better in 15. We're not significantly better, and we need to get to 80%. So I think we're very likely that we'll see the deposit value increase to 10 cents. And then 2018, January 1, 2018, is the expansion that's already in the law. So Joe's group and my group are feverishly working to make sure that the capacity to handle both of those items is in place. You know, we're expecting, the only other state that has a 10 cent deposit on all containers is Michigan, and they have a rate in the mid to upper 90s. So that would be a big change in what goes back to grocery stores, what goes back to redemption centers, going from somewhere in the low 70s to the mid 90s. So a lot of capacity to take on. And then the expansion to the expanded class is another 20-25%. Bump in the containers over the years. People have moved away from carbonated soft drinks and into other types of beverages, and many of those aren't currently covered, and so that expanded class includes those. So that's kind of an overview of the bottle bill. Let me talk a little bit about bottle drop redemption centers. So in 2010, OBRC created the redemption center concept bottle drop. We did it for two reasons. One was to improve the customer return experience. And if, no offense to my grocery brethren next to me, if any of you have wandered by a bottle return room in recent years, you probably recognize that there's room for improvement, albeit slight. a little room for improvement in the customer return experience. And so we're pursuing that with bottle drop. And then also pursuing removing the high volume returns from grocery stores. And what had become, or what had started, at least in my time, which I'm going on 22 years working with the bottle bill, it used to be that most stores got back more or less what they sold. And as over the last 10-15 years, I would say those returns started to shift heavily to the largest grocery stores, to the point where many of Joe's group were getting 150% of what they sold. And, you know, it was kind of a catch-22. The more they made it convenient for the customer, the more other customers came. And
Madam Chair, for the record, Joe Gilliam, that did happen. We had 300, John put up, there's 3,000 locations where they pick up bottles and cans where they returned. 70% went to 300 locations. So the other 2,300 got the other 30%. And it was kind of a catch-22 for grocers. You want to do the right thing. You want to make it work for your customer, which only created more volume coming back. You try to keep up with it, then you're in a kind of a spiral, and you really can't keep up with the volume. We had some locations that get 300% of what they sell because of their location, they're near a border, or for a lot of reasons. Well, you're just trying to keep up with that capacity. You only can pedal so fast on the deal. So the bottle drop centers have made a huge difference in areas where we've adjusted those stores.
So we currently have 11 bottle drop centers open. And we have an eventual goal of 45 statewide. We have those open in Wood Village, Oregon City, South Salem, Northeast Portland, Gresham, North Salem, Bend, Eugene, Redmond, Medford, and North Portland. And we are targeting for 2015 right now that we have potential properties, one in Klamath Falls, one in Tigard, and one in Albany. Our goal is to open four a year, which doesn't seem like a lot, but it's a fairly massive undertaking given that the concept really didn't exist before we created it, and we're a relatively small organization that was used to picking up cans and bottles out of grocery stores, not running retail operations. So it's been a big challenge to put everything together, and for a year, finding four properties that work, and there's a lot of challenges in that, is the best we could do, I think, realistically.
The market has changed for properties, and I think that's the biggest challenge for the Bottle Bill right now, is we're not always the prime tenant people want because of the nature of our business and the bottles and cans and such. And so as you get into a rising real estate market, the properties and locations become less and less. So that's our challenge. But if we can do 4 year, because of the model difference, we just don't use the old machines anymore like you have at the grocery store. This is actually a conveyor system that's in the back that is very sophisticated. It counts and sorts every commodity. So it makes the experience in the front end, it looks like a machine in the front end, but it's going 3 to 4 times faster than a machine. And the secret's in the back. And it takes a little while to get those up and running and make them right.
So the average bottle drop center is about 7,000 square feet with 30-plus parking spaces. We're open 7 days a week, 9 to 11 hours a day, depending on the location and the time of year. We open longer in summer because there's more containers consumed in the summer. We're open 363 days a year. We close for Christmas and Thanksgiving. For now, I guess. I don't know if it'll last. We have a program where a drop-off service, basically, where customers can fill bags up, drop them at our facility, and we'll count them. I'll talk about that a little bit more here in a minute. But the bottle drop account holders have a night drop door, essentially, that is activated by a card they have, and so they can drop off 24 hours a day. And we have a lot of people that do that. The operating funds for bottle drop centers are shared by distributors and retailers, thus the partnership with Joe and his group. The average site capital cost for one of these, the construction, either tenant improvements or if it was a facility from the ground up, which we really haven't done exclusively for bottle drop, is about $1.5 million. And OBRC is financing that through our distributor members. And then the average site operating costs are about $500,000 annually, and that's what we're splitting with the grocery retailers. Varies a little bit. We haven't done really small town sites yet. We anticipate doing that, but they won't be. I don't expect them to be $500,000. They'll probably be $350,000 or something more in that range. And we have nearly all distributors and large retailers that are participating now. So have where we've opened a center, they've joined in, including most recently Walmart, which obviously is a large retailer in the state, and we're happy to have them participating now. So really, the largest retailer that has at this point chosen not to participate is Walgreens, and I know we're working to try to bring them on board, but it's been a challenge. Even for Joe. And
yeah. We've had some problems with, particularly Walgreens now, where they don't see it as a, it's an inconvenience. So they aren't complying with the law. They aren't providing the equivalent services of the redemption center. They're just not doing anything. And so they end up in a situation where they're just getting a free ride for everything they put into the system. So there is legislation that we're bringing forward to give OLC more guidance, because one of their frustrations is they're not sure what their latitude is to bring these folks in. So we were going to work on a bill to clarify their authority to say, you're either in or out, which is fine, but once you're out, you got to play by the rules.
So I have some bottle drop statistics here. I think it gives you some idea of the magnitude of the program and the shift in really most of the populated areas in the state, with a few exceptions. Away from traditional return to grocery retailers and to this redemption center format. We're projecting in 2015, this year, that we'll process about 350 million units. That's compared with about 250 million that we took offline from grocery retailers. So of all the retailers that are participating, they were getting back 250 million units. We're getting back almost 30% more through our centers. So clearly people have chosen to use the bottle drop centers over what they were returning, the quantities they were returning to the participating retailers in a large number. Some of the centers that we've gone to are 200% what we were experiencing before. Some of the areas where It's geographically isolated, like Ben Redmond, where you don't have a lot of other population areas that can come in. We've seen just an overall lift in the redemption rate for the entire town when we open it. So we know people like it, and we have a lot of anecdotal evidence that suggests that, as well as the numbers that we see come in. That volume that I referred to there equals about 33% of the state's volume. So by the end of 2015, we have 11 sites open now. We'd be adding four more. So we'd have 15 sites and 15 locations we would project are doing a third of the state's return volume. So pretty dramatic shift in consumer return behaviors across the pretty much the entire state. I have some maps that show you where we're at right now with these centers. How are they returning containers? Consumers, about 80% are using reverse vending machines. And as Joe explained, the machine looks and acts completely different in our bottle drop centers than it does at a grocery retailer. It is a lot faster, uses completely different technology, doesn't compact in the base of the machine. We use centralized compactors, so it's much faster. Consumers love it. The bar wasn't very high, but even still, consumers use it, and their eyes get big, and they're happy. About 17% of our customers, or the volume our customers bring in, are coming through the bottle drop account, the drop service that we have, bag service. I'll talk about that a little bit more, but just that varies too by location, by geographic area in the Gresham, Wood Village, Oregon City area, although Oregon City's a little bit farther off, but those were some of our longest running centers or open centers. We're closer to 50% of the users in that area are using the drop service, where we count those. Then we still have about 3% of our users that ask for a hand count, and we provide hand counts for 50 or less. And if someone looks like they really need a hand count and they have 55 or whatever, we'll hand count them too. So we do have people that want that, and we provide that service to them. We're projecting our operating costs this year will be really close, hopefully, if we're on budget, which we should be, to be about $6.7 million. Once we roll out to 45 centers, we're projecting annual operating costs of about $22 million. And we expect that to be, at least on the initial round of capital, about $65 million in capital construction and equipment costs. We expect that we'll probably have to replace equipment after 6 or 7 years, so some of those construction costs will come back up again, but that's kind of an estimate of what that is. So we have 60,000 families currently with bottle drop accounts. That's the drop bag drop service. We're averaging about 75 new account holders daily. This is really ramped up in the last 2 years because we've really only ramped up our sites in the last 2 years. But at that pace, we'd be adding about 27,000 families a year to that 60,000. And I expect as we open each new center that there's a little bit of exponential math that goes on in that as well. We've got thousands of transactions for a program that Joe has implemented called Bottle Drop Plus, where participating grocers offer a 20% premium. So instead of getting 5 cents back, you get 6 cents if you choose to spend your bottle drop credits in their store. And Joe's having good success with that. And
we're seeing people come to it. It's slow as they hear about it. We don't do huge marketing campaign just because the dollar's available, but every time we go introduce it at the door where people are dropping off the bottle drop, it rises, and the folks can come in and do up to $80 of what they have in their account. For $80, they get $96 in a store credit. $10, they get $12. And they spend it at the store, they get a little more for their money, and we try to encourage the redemption rate and business in our stores, frankly, with our customers.
And we like it because, as we've learned, the cost of managing the amount of cash that we need to pay out at our redemption centers. We have an automated machine that we pay it out of, but it's still armored car has to load it, and you have to pay the bank for the cash. And so that's an expensive part of what we're doing. And any customers that we can transition over to get that convert that ticket for what's on their account to a grocery store purchase is good for both of us there. We're getting back about 2,700 bags per day in the summer, especially peak around the holidays. That can be 3,000-4,000 bags. So a lot of bags. We have automated equipment to count it, but it's still a lot of small bags that have to be managed. So I have a few maps here. This one is OBRC has really five cost centers around the state, zones we call them, and this map shows the stars that you can see here are the approximate locations of the centers that we have open. I know there's a big zero there, but we'll work on that. But the percentage here represents the amount of volume that's going through the bottle drop centers for that zone. So in the greater zone one here, 36% of the volume is going through the seven centers that we have in Portland. In our zone two, which there's one in Eugene, 10.5% are going through one center. Our zone three down in Medford, we open one center and we have 29% of the volume from that area going through. Now we're going to open one in Klamath Falls here, I hope, within 3 months here. And I expect that we'll probably see closer to 45% in that zone. In Central Oregon here, we have two, one in Redmond, one in Bend. We're doing 61% of the volume from there. And then still haven't found the right location, but we would like to see one eventually in Hermiston in Ontario. This map here shows the...
Representative Holby.
A quick question just on those percentages. Is that the percentage 61% is that the percentage of bottles returned or going through the redemption centers?
Correct. Okay. Percentage going through the redemption center relative to all of the returns to grocery stores in that zone.
So of 100% in that zone that were returned anywhere, 61% went through the redemption center.
I do a quick follow-up. I'm, you know, listening to this, I'm curious if you have statistics that show the percentage of bottles that are returned. You know, over the years, and seeing how, you know, I mean, you I think you have or mentioned some statistics where some stores are, you know, collecting 150% of what they actually sell. Do we have those kind of numbers statewide so we can see, you know, how many of the bottles are actually being returned as a percentage-wise total, and see if that percentage is actually increasing or decreasing over time?
Yeah, we do have those. It's decreasing. It's about 70% of what is sold is being returned.
And what was it 5 years ago?
5 years ago, it was probably 78. 15 years ago, it was in the mid-80s.
So that tells me that we're actually returning a smaller percentage of bottles are being redeemed.
Yes, that's absolutely correct.
The reason I bring that up is because, you know, I think I hear from a lot of people it's just not convenient. They're putting their bottles in, you know, the recycling box going to the dump or, you know, whatever, instead of actually redeeming them. So that's kind of what I was trying to get at. Is there a strategy to turn that sort of that around?
Madam Chair, Representative Holby, to give you an idea, you are fighting just what you're saying, where curbside is very convenient, so people put it curbside and off it goes. Now, good news, it gets recycled, so it's right. not much of it's going into the waste stream, so there's the good news. When you look at Salem, when we opened the pilot project that you all approved, the rate around the state went down 2% that year, and after a year of running here, statewide down 2%, up 6%. By opening one center in Salem. So the Salem area just went up 6%. So we're starting to chip away at finding that more convenient way why people would bring them back through the redemption system. Now, there's still going to be questions whether people are putting curbside over time, you know, and what does that mean? If we go to a dime in 2017, which looks like we will, I think you're going to see a whole new set of statistics of where how much comes back. Because if you think about it, if you look at the bottom of your receipt, you look at your deposits, you see $1.20, you see $2.40, you may not get exercised about that too much, and curbside seems like a better deal. All of a sudden it's $4.80, and then 2018, you add all the other drinks, and all of a sudden that's $5, $6, $7 in deposits, and that's people are going to look at that differently about how much money they have tied up in redeemable deposits.
And so, you know, my conclusion being wrong probably that it's those figures don't really indicate that the redemption is less, I guess, convenient. It's that curbside is more convenient, perhaps, because as curbside's been increasing, that redemption is going.
So
I don't know if that's a correct conclusion either. It's just speculation.
I think that's what we see in the waste stream too, is the studies and such. So you got, you know, if it's just easier to go to your curb and put them in, then people give up that nickel. Now, you go to a dime, there's gonna be a different reflection on that, because we know we're seeing people who come to our bottle drop plus program for a penny, store credit, go every penny counts and grabs it. So that's at 6 cents. So 10 cents is another big jump.
Madam Chair.
Representative Widener.
Thank you. Prompted something there, because they're getting recycled. So on curbside, they're not ending up in the waste. If we did away with the deposit altogether and just had them recycled or did curbside, then people wouldn't have to pay that deposit on there, and we could drop the cost of it. So the stores don't have to deal with them. We have them being recycled and everything else. That seems like a pretty decent, because otherwise, I mean, if I'm having to pay an extra dime on my, I get a case of water, and the water is $2, and then I got $2 in deposit on it, it's almost 100% tax on it, so that you have to take back to redeem, where I could just throw them out curbside.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Widener, I tried that argument in 2007.
It didn't work.
And today I'm building redemption centers. So in all seriousness, though, there's two pieces of the bottle bill. It was not meant to be a recycling piece. So in 1971, there was no curbside. Okay. And the recycling was a added benefit, but it was a litter piece.
We didn't really do recycling.
Yeah. If Representative Berger was here, which we don't have her doing her piece this year, is talk about her dad's experience, right. And he'd see them on the trail. He was a very avid hiker and a beach guy. And there, you know, it was the litter on the beach. So you got the litter component. So if you get rid of the deposit, will people pick them up if people litter? And so, you know, we're pretty proud in terms of the litter process here. But it is an expensive process. There's no doubt about it. I mean, we're showing you the numbers, and this is what it takes to run this. It's not cheap. But in 2007 and a half, we decided everybody's committed. Once you expand into water bottles, you made a policy decision, you're committed into the expansion and making it work. And so doing it efficiently is really the key now. I mean, curbside's great. It works.
Yeah.
But we're going to do as efficiently as we can and make it as pleasant as possible. I mean, these redemption centers, you go in, they're well lit, they're heated, they're cleaned up every night. They're not like our bottle areas on the side of the store where we can't keep up with it. So it is a vast improvement in the experience.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, as you guys all know, I voted against all of these bills. And if you'll go back to your slide showing my part of the world, you'll see why. why don't we just do that? Can we go back?
Sure. Was at the 0-0? Yeah,
right, there we go. And the thing that I'm happy for on the one hand but kind of sad for on the other, and you can maybe address this, this works really well in highly populated areas. It works really badly in poverty-stricken areas. Because mm-hmm. $5, $6, $7 that you're talking about in a couple of years that people will have to pay in addition to their grocery charges, they don't readily have available. And so this concept that we'll run down to the redemption center and pick up a slip of paper and run down to the store then doesn't work. So you've got to, how it's going to work out in my part of the world is really unclear, other than that poor people are going to have a tougher time paying for that which they need. So I think it's great that people will see much more clearly the cost of keeping our roadsides clean and everything else picked up. But on the other hand, it's become a recycling device and a very expensive one. I want to go back, because you need to refresh my memory. I went back to look at some of the newspaper articles from 2 years ago, because there was quite a bit of talk about how the 80% was going to be achieved. I think it was going to be achieved by virtue of the well-functioning, well-oiled machine of these recycling centers. Am I right? Is my memory failing me? Because I fear that ain't working, and we're going to go to a dime, just like those like me said, leading to people going, just like Representative Widener said, into Idaho to buy cases of water from Costco and coming back into Oregon and making a pretty good living that way, to, you know, dumping the water out along the way and just turning the plastic in. Now, that's going to work even better once we go to a dime. So the first question would be, what's being done to try to stop all of that theft, basically, from the system? Because it existed before, and this is a strangely deja vu moment because I've had the same conversation two times previous. Mm-hmm. So here we are today. So my question would be, how are these recycling centers going to work, and is there any chance? I looked at the graph that I think you're about to get to, or maybe went by, showing that we're well below the 80%. And I think you already said we ain't going to make it. So should I go home and start telling everybody to get ready for the dime? Is that what I'm supposed to do?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Bentz, I think it's a complicated equation, and it gets pretty deep. But I think the bottom line is this: you're fighting two things in a consumer's mind. You're fighting the value of the deposit against the effort to return the container. And we recognize, I think, collectively, most of us that would see a traditional bottle room, that the effort to get the container is relatively high. If we have to go stand in front of machines, maybe they're broken, maybe they're full, maybe the floor is sticky, and the value of the nickel just isn't worth what it was in prior days. So you have a declining value for the return, a decreasing return experience. And so what we had hoped years ago was that simply by changing the return experience, we could turn the redemption rate around. What I want to point out, what I've been trying to point out in the last couple slides in terms of the percentage of returns that are going to bottle drop, is we did accomplish what we set out to accomplish in terms of providing a better experience for consumers. It's clear the numbers don't lie. It's just not enough to fight a deflating nickel. And the one thing you can look at that can't be disputed is in the 40 states where there is no deposit legislation, there's almost zero return of valuable commodities to recycle centers. Now, there are some people that would save up their cans and go sell them for what the value of aluminum is, but it's probably less than 5%. So you know from 40 states that when the deposit value is zero, there's almost zero returns. And so we're heading towards zero in terms of real value of a nickel relative to what it was in 1971. And I think you can look at that and say, okay, there would be no light at the end of this tunnel if the deposit stayed at a nickel. Now, the other thing I would say is mark it on your calendar the day that two industry guys are being badgered about whether a bottle bill is a good thing or not. They're typically not supported by grocery retailers and beverage distributors. So Joe and I find ourselves in a unique situation in that because policy is set by you folks, not us, but it has been left to us to solve the challenges of the bottle bill. We have done that to the best of our ability and our knowledge. And so if you make the argument that the bottle bill should go away, it's not really my place to say, no, it shouldn't. I know there's a lot of people that would say that, but that's not my place. My place is, if you say you want the bottle bill, we're going to do the best that we can to make it a good, efficient program for the state. And I just want to point out on these last two slides, these dots here, these colors that you see represent those 60,000 families that have signed up for bottle drop accounts. This is statewide, and you can see these colors represent Oregon City and Gresham and so forth. This is one in North Salem, South Salem. This is Eugene, Redmond, Bend, and Medford. This is a close-up of the Portland metro area. The red is Oregon City, one of our first ones. Green, kind of hidden Wood Village, Gresham, Gleason, and now Delta Park. And then this is a zoomed-in map, and it doesn't show very well. But this is Oregon City. This is the Redemption Center in Oregon City, and these are the neighborhoods around. So these red dots represent a household that's signed up for bottle drop. And you can see that pretty much anywhere there's residential around this Redemption Center, there are bottle drop account holders that are on these streets and in these neighborhoods. And my point, Representative Bentz, is that is there a light at the end of the tunnel? Is there a way that we turn this and avoid the 10 cents? I don't think that there is statistically, but I think this gives you an idea. This density of people wanting to use the bottle drop program gives you an idea of the impact that we can make in the decision-making habits or the decision-making decisions of Oregonians when it comes to how they want to return their containers and so forth.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Follow up.
Okay, so at no point have I said I'm against the bottle bill. What I'm against is the fact that it's been expanded to become a garbage collection bill, and also the impact it's having on poverty, the poverty-stricken folk in my area. I have no idea how this plays out for folks that are on food stamps. I've never tried to trace it through. But I will say that it's one of those things that sounds good as you expand it out, but it has much different impacts in my part of the world than it does in what we're looking at right here. That's my point. And I'm not blaming you two. I'm saying we voted. Yeah, I voted no. I lost. Now here we are. I just want to make sure the consequences of those votes are clear. And I think you're making it so, and I appreciate that.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that's the point we're kind of getting at to follow up on Representative Bentz was saying and everything. I think it's something we have to look at policy-wise, too. Is it something that's necessary? Because I travel all over the country, and I don't see bottles all over the streets and roads in other states that don't have a bottle bill, because I think people naturally want to do the right thing, and now recycling has become so convenient, and a lot of your garbage places are sorting a lot of this stuff out, too, when the garbage comes out. They have very sophisticated systems for handling it. So I think you guys are doing a great job. What's happening is great, but I think we also need to be careful that we're not hurting a lot of people out there that are living day to day. And then some people, you know, with addictions and things like that that might be on food stamps could go in and buy, when we go to a dime, you buy a case of water, go out and you dump it out in the parking lot and just go return it. And that's the kind of stuff that could start happening with this. So we need to be careful in balancing that happy medium between the two. This is probably something that even should be looked at in other committees besides just here. I mean, we're on the environmental side, but we are creating something that could turn into a profit center for people.
Madam Chair, Representative Wider, it goes on today at a nickel. I mean, human nature is, I'm going to be blunt with you, I can't buy tobacco and I can't buy alcohol on my SNAP benefits, my Oregon Trail card. So I'll buy three cases of water, dump it in the parking lot. Some people just shove it in the machines full of water and it blows them up, as John will tell you. Yeah. And then they take that little bit of cash in and go buy tobacco and alcohol. Can you stop that? You can't stop it. I mean, this is this piece of human nature that no matter if you have a nickel, a dime, or 15 cents, someone's going to figure out how to, you know, bust a system and do something different. So I agree with you. Boy, I don't know if there's much to do about it. It's kind of tough to get after.
So I remember from, I think it was last session when we had it, we actually had the cost. We had the, there was a statistic that was given on the loss, right? The money that's either not returned and what that rate was. And then there was like a balance on where it's being sold more or it's being sold less, but there's actually more being brought in. And I don't know if you guys could provide that information, but I think that was a picture on in terms of what is the, you know, what are we selling in the state that we're not recycling, and then what are, where are the places where it's being sold and not at the rate that it's actually getting returned?
Well, in broad terms, Madam Chair, it's, you just go along the borders, and that's where it's more being returned than being sold. And as you go to the interior of the state, it reverses itself. But, you know, as you put the redemption centers in, Ben and Red is very interesting. It's up to 61%. So that's as interior as you get to the state. And that's really changing because of the convenience and what how people's attitudes. So I don't know if our statistics are going to hold up over time. I think they're going to change over time. And but I can tell you, we just closed down the border stores in North Portland and put a center in Delta Park. And that is a big change because those are the two most high-volume stores, the Safeway at Jansen Beach and the Fred Meyer at Interstate, are now offline and they're in the Redemption Center. And that's very new, so we're watching the numbers to see what happens down there because that's going to be a huge change, what you're talking about. The Fred Meyer store at Interstate took in 300% of what they sold. It was the highest one in the state. So, you know, that throws the numbers off, but it's basically coming in from Vancouver.
Got a follow-up?
Actually, on that, because that's, I mean, I'm thinking Ontario, where Cliff's talking about, and with Idaho on the other side, what those numbers are, because now they have to say where they're from. So do we give, if somebody's from Washington, can they just get cash right there, or do they have to give their name and address, or just get cash without giving an address?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Widener, the law just says basically that we're required as a dealer or a redemption center to provide a 5-cent refund for a container that's properly marked, and the implication is a container that's properly marked is one that has been sold in Oregon. So if you live in Washington, which there are a lot of people that live in downtown Vancouver that shop at the Jansen Beach Safeway because it's as close as another grocery store in Washington would be or in Vancouver would be. So you can't really look at driver's licenses or anything like that. It's somewhat of an honor system, but one of the things I think that's unique, I know is unique about Oregon's bottle bill when you compare it to others around the country, is that the distributors are responsible for the monetary flow inside that bottle bill. And so if there is a big concern about containers coming across the border from Idaho or Vancouver or, you know, Stevenson or White Salmon or wherever those border towns are, it's the distributors that bear the financial blow for that. And so, you know, and I represent distributors. And when I go to the distributors and talk to them about the possible ways we can solve this, usually the cost to solve it is more than the cost impact of the system. I mean, the reality of it is you've got to move a lot. We're talking about 1.2 billion containers that are 1.5 billion containers that are sold in the state, 1.2 billion, give or take, that are returned. And you got to move a lot of containers from Vancouver, White Salmon, Stevenson, whatever's in Walla Walla. I mean, it's just, it's hard to move that needle enough financially to figure out carrying two different inventories, which is essentially what the distributors would have to do. If you have to put one can in Vancouver and one right across the border in Jansen Beach, and it just costs too much to do that.
I will say, Madam Chair, anecdotally, what we're starting to see, too, is the fraud issue is easy when it's kind of the machines are unmanned and you can just stand out there and keep shoving them through the machines and no one's watching you. So there, it takes, you got to be a lot more bold to come into the redemption center, and we allow 350 per day per person in the redemption center. It used to be 144 per day per person at the machines, but pretty hard for us to police every day watching people at the machines. You're trying to sell groceries and take care of people and keep an eyeball on the machines. Well, to go into Jansen Beach or to go into Interstate Fred Meyer and just stand there at the machines and shove them through, now you got to go inside, and we have full-time people, and if you come in with stacks of thousands, we're not going to let you go through that. It's 350 a day per person, and to watch, you know, to meter that out. So it's not quite as easy. So as we get more of these established, particularly in the Portland area and as we go down the borders, then we're going to see if it really does make an effect of how many people want to come in and go and try to do this. But you won't be able to do thousands at a time and just stand there and shove them in the machines. You know, we can police it a little better because our employees that are in these redemption centers, this is what they do. They're not running in to sell groceries. They're not doing clerk duties. They're not stocking shelves. They're not getting shopping carts. Their only job is to make sure those centers run and they're watching the intakes.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the
for the presentation. I asked for this because it's an issue that we needed to have an update on, those of us that have been in the building the last two sessions. But I'm discouraged. You know, I was one of the guys that supported both these bills in 2011 to go to a dime, and we were assured by the distributors that wouldn't happen. And then to go to the expansion in 13, where again we were assured that we wouldn't be at a dime, and therefore that impact wouldn't be as great as it will be. And also, the feedback that I get from my retailers who say they got to have these dang things out of the building before we expand to every container, because there is no way they can handle it. They just can't. They can't keep up with the product they have now. When we go to every beverage container, what are they going to do? I mean, I can't walk through my neighborhood store hardly without seeing the branch manager and saying, when are we going to get our redemption center in the Gorge, because we don't have one. We got to go to Wood Village. And our people oftentimes, unless you commute to Portland, it's a 60-mile drive. That doesn't pencil out. You know that. So I'm just saying, you know, 45 is the goal statewide. You're at 11, four per year. That doesn't get you built out in 3 years. So what are we going to do?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, that's really going to be a policy decision on your point. Our job for John and I has been head down, find properties, put these up as fast as we can, and make them efficient. I mean, part of the, you know, we could throw stuff up and it'd be cost too much. You know, the property is an issue that we did not really see coming. As the economy comes back, we've lost six properties in downtown Portland trying to put one in because people don't want us. The city gives us a hard time. You know, we can't have that in our neighborhood. Even though you have it in your neighborhood in six different stores, we couldn't have that in our neighborhood. It didn't make any sense, right? So we've been up against challenges like that. If you see property, and I'm being honest about this, call us, because we are looking for, we're trying to, if we could do 3 years out and have properties that we know we're going to, we would have them that way. And I think that's our biggest challenge. If you see this, and as a group you say, we're not going to make it, we need to, you know, make adjustments to dimes and deadlines and all that stuff, we'll work with you on it. But until that kind of comes up here, we're going toward 45 as fast as we can. I mean, we just can't let our foot off the gas pedal.
So do you have the resources to build out as quick as you can find property?
We have so far. We've been in pretty good shape with that. We've had the resources, and we've been able to do it. But we need to do 4 year steady to make this work. And I might say it's not a challenge, but we're out there every day looking at property and finding areas. So far, we haven't run out of supply. But I worry more than John, but it backs up in my stores.
No question about it.
It backs up in my stores, so I get more nervous. I'd like to have six laid out, and we just haven't been able to find locations to get out to that six. That's in my head. That's where I feel comfortable. Is you have six to go, and you're always building. But it's a race. Don't get me wrong. It's a race in time right now, and you got our feet to the fire.
Paul. Representative Foley, did you want to add?
I just want to, you know, how does the dime impact all of this?
Madam Chair, Representative Foley.
How does a dime impact all of this?
Yeah, that's a little question, but I do want to respond to Representative Johnson here. Just so you know, I grew up in Hood River, and my wife's parents still live in Parkdale, and they let me know that Rosauer's machines are down. And they need to be fixed, and they remind me that we need a redemption center. So I've not forgotten about your area there. We will get to it, and maybe sooner rather than later. But the dime, it's a complicated question. We don't know what will happen. We know it will. We know it will increase return rates. It just naturally will do it. The state we've seen, as an example, Michigan is in the mid-90s. So we know there will be more returns going to stores. We just hope that we have enough centers by that time open to really take the blunt of that volume. Clearly, we're doing a lot. We have 11 centers open. We're doing a third of the state's volume. So we're making significant headway. 2017 is eight more centers. By the time we get there and midway through 17, when this would probably happen, we would have 12 more. I mean, we could be doing 50-55%. So it's not an insurmountable hurdle. We wish we had a little more time, but we understand that legislation is in place. And
does the dime help you get there quicker?
Make it a buck.
No.
Does it help us get more centers faster? No, I think it probably complicates the trying to put this together.
Madam Chair, Representative Holvey, no one's ever raised their deposit. Michigan has a dime. No one's gone from 5 to 10. So we don't have any state to look at and say, here's what happened in that state. Yeah. We're going to be the guinea pigs on that on the issue. But, you know, 5 to 10 is, you know, it's a big deal. If you go back a couple slides here, the interesting thing is even though our zones are out to 3.5 miles, if you look, show me one of the, those zones there, that's out 10. So people do come to these redemption centers, and if our volume goes up, they will make that trip. And the bag, I think the bag is the equalizing factor. The bag drops, you don't have to stand in front of a machine.
I agree.
That's the piece that makes a difference for folks. It costs a few pennies to have your stuff counted, but you can go by 24 hours a day, dump in the door, and you're off, and you have it on a card. And you can walk in a grocery store and get your cash or get 20% more. I think that's how we get where we're going to be.
Okay, so I'm happy to, I'm so glad I have such an enthusiastic committee. We are a little bit over, so Representative Helm, I'm going to have you give you the pleasure of having the last question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Short, easy question. On the 6 sites that you say you lost in Portland to try to get centers in there, what were the reasons? Were you denied a land use permit, or did you kind of give up because the opposition looked tough?
Madam Chair, Representative Helm, variety of reasons. A couple of landlords played us against other tenants.
Okay.
And as soon as we got up there, then they, oh, I'm sorry, you're out. You know, what do you do? We tried to buy a building, got played against another. They jacked the price up, and someone else said, I got to have it. And so we were in that mix. That happens. We did have a building on Burnside. Two things. Neighbors went little nuts because even though that there was a bottle room 2 blocks up at the Fred Meyer store and it was going to be 2 blocks over here, but we also found it had oil underneath it, yeah. And lead poisoning from used to paint trolley cars there and with lead paint back in the 1890s, and then it had tanks on it before. And for the liability for us, we don't have those kind of deep pockets. What are we going to do if it's a triangle in between Burnside and Alder. And to dig that hole and dig it out, the shoring you'd have to put in on this small hole so it didn't cave in, enough of that. So we're still looking. So it's been a variety of things.
Well, thank you both so much for coming today. Obviously a lot of interest on this and a lot of challenges coming up and opportunities in the couple of years ahead as we look at this. So good luck and thank you for your time.
Thank you.
With that, I'm going to close the informational meeting on the bottle drop organ. Hold on 1 second. So we are not going to hear the Senate bill 456 today. We'll have to do that another day. And I just wanted to let you know that the deadline to submit bills is going to be on Wednesday. So on Tuesday's meeting, we're going to have work sessions on getting the last of the committee bills in. So if you have anything that you want, please get them to Beth as soon as possible. And also plan on Tuesday going late, probably another an hour, like probably going until about 6, because we're going to be hearing a little bill called Senate Bill 324, clean fuels. So we'll have a lot of testimony on that. So just, bring a snack. Okay. And with that, I'm going to go ahead and close the meeting of the House Energy and Environment Committee.
You think Beth's not going to bring pizza?
Yeah.
You think Beth's not going to bring pizza?
The Environment Committee.